Okay. So today I was going to make this a pick a question that the Sangha has submitted day, and we may still get to that, but then in Zazen, a topic came to me. So I'll just chat about it for a while and we can have a little discussion and see where that goes. It's clearly summertime, and it's lovely outside, and people are starting to travel and have family plans and various things like that. And I know myself, in addition to my responsibilities with the Zen Center and the podcast and all that, I'm like, oh, I want to get out in my yard. And I'd love to make a trip to the coast with my friend and all that. And it's very when I sit down to think, like, all right, what kind of Dharma talk should I give? It's almost just like Dharma. It's like I don't know. I think the question of how to hold our practice, how to keep our practice alive, how to stay in touch with it during times like this or at any time really, is a very appropriate thing to talk about this time of year. And I was thinking about really answering this question for myself in a way, right? I have to maintain contact with my practice if I am going to help you maintain contact with yours, right? So I thought about a little the other day we had a meeting, and Greg Kulik, was talking about some kind of issue that comes up for him, and that he had something that he does in his mind that he called a hack. So I thought, now this brings to mind, like, I have a little hack, right? If you are kind of wondering, whether your practice is languishing or whatever, a little hack of asking yourself, how do I want to have lived? Very simple. How do I want to have lived? And you can give that a framing, as in tomorrow. Say your life ends tomorrow. How do I want to have lived today? Or you can give it a longer framework, right? If you live a nice long life and you look back, how do you want to have lived? Or you can give it another framing, like, whatever happens with our climate and ecological crisis over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and how do you want to have lived? Or whatever issue concerns you and that you think is going to be very significant from that perspective, how do you want to have lived? And I like this way of approaching it, because it removes it from some kind of ideal. It's just this has this is really only effective. It's 100% sincere, right? It's not about how do you think you should have lived. It's not about how somebody else lives. It's not about how a good Buddhist lives. How do you want to have lived? And I feel like this is the reason that this is effective is the same reason like Zen is effective, right? Zen is like you don't have to fix anything. You just have to get in touch with what is true. So what, we can really trust this if we really ask ourselves, because, we always think, well, maybe I, how do I want to have lived? Well, I want to have just, like, I don't know, slept my time away, or I want to have just been caught up in trying to get lots of material possessions. That's what I want to have done. I mean, it's like deep down, we all have something very sincere. And I think, but even this question and the answers could become something that we beat ourselves up with, or is a source of guilt, or whatever. Right? How do I want to? Oh, I want to have lived it. I want a better person. And now I'm not doing that. And basically, in any time that it starts to turn that way, we're going down the wrong road, right? Then we're just like getting tangled up in our ideas, comparing ourselves to our own ideals or other people's ideals or whatever. So that, like, if it starts to feel icky, just brush it away, but really sincerely. And I will be honest myself that if I ask myself this throughout much of my day, much of my week, I am not in perfect alignment with how I want to have lived. I mean, obviously there are irritations, annoyances, or whatever, which, if I look at it from the perspective of how I want to have lived, I'm like, well, I don't want to have been made miserable or neurotic by these things, which from that perspective do not look important anymore, right? But also there is our tendency, my tendency, to, for most of my awareness, most of my consciousness, energy, and interest to be focused on the near future. Lunch with my husband. Tomorrow I have an accordion lesson. And then on Tuesday I'm gonna get to that long list of Brightway Zen stuff and I'll get back to Aaron, right? Like there's like, and I've got all that stuff which I am looking forward to, or at least looking forward to finishing or whatever. And that's where like a large part of my consciousness is. And it's not really here, appreciating this moment, this time, the way things actually are right now, which is where I want to have lived here, right? Not in that sense of anticipation. Not that there's anything wrong with that, right? It's kind of a matter of degree. Just that sense of anticipation. Others are different. You may spend a lot of time thinking about the past or other situations or what have you. So, how do we want to have lived? And I was thinking about how the framework of the Buddhist Six Realms is very helpful, I think, in identifying our different states of mind, which mean essentially we're not living in alignment with our deepest aspirations. And that, I guess, is cosmology, right? So this is the Buddhist view of the universe, but as I've said many times, in any kind of literal sense, this is something that the Buddha inherited. This is a way that they saw the universe in India at the time of the Buddha. And so he built Buddhism within that framework. But I personally do not view that framework, view believing in this framework in any literal way, as being at all necessary to practice or Buddhism. You can believe it or not believe it. It doesn't really matter. Like, it's not necessary in my There might be some Buddhists out there who believe it is, but I don't think it's necessary. But it's not necessary to disbelieve it, whatever. But I think that the cosmology of it anyway is very rich. like the Joseph Campbell view of myth, right? Myth tells, has truth in it. It does not have to be necessarily literally true, but it has truth in it. So this cosmology of the six realms, which many of you might be familiar with, is that there's not just heaven and hell. There is a heaven and there's a hell, but there's actually six realms. And in the Buddhist view, you don't get stuck in any of the realms. There, your karma, the causes and effects of, or the effects of your own actions, are what have you end up in a particular realm. And so part of the cosmology is that after death, you're going to be reborn, and you come face to face with Mara, the deity of the desire realm, which is the whole thing. And he just holds up a mirror. And so this is the perfect thing. How do you want to have lived, right? Like, this is not about anybody judging you, but there's holding up a mirror, and you get to look at like how you lived. Damn, like, oh, I guess I'll go over, like, you end up in a particular realm based on that. And then, like, if you see the image of the six realms, you'll see little people like flying around this little inner circle, and they're like, they've just died, and now they're like headed to one of the realms. So it shows these six realms. And the human realm is the one that we are in, and that is a good realm to be in. It's not too miserable, not too wonderful. So we're motivated to practice. Now, the heaven realm is, and what is useful here is thinking of these as states of mind or being that we can end up in. And then there's a way out of each realm, which is liberating. So we can liberate ourselves from every one of the realms. You may sound strange to want to be liberated from heaven. But when we are in the heaven realm, we are not motivated to practice. We're just want to enjoy it. And there's nothing sinister about that. We just want to enjoy it. But what we don't realize, what we forget, is that everything is impermanent. And we won't be there forever. Things will change. We won't be there forever. So we're just kind of lulled into complacency because we're enjoying ourselves, and then we forget. So I feel like many of us, especially in the summertime, spend a lot of time in the heaven realm. It's just like, eh. I got plenty of time, right? Like, I'll do some study or something in the fall, right? Like, and yet everything could change. And not only that, when things change, it will seem like they changed like that, right? No matter if it's 10 years from now, 20 years from now, it'll be just like, man, like, so there's the heaven realm. So in the heaven realm, what we can do is remind ourselves of impermanence. And it doesn't have to be a miserable, like, beating ourselves over, flagellating ourselves or something for being happy or enjoying ourselves, but just, contemplating, which is actually all around us, contemplating impermanence, contemplating the inconstancy of things, right? And how the inconstancy of what it is that we enjoy, whether that is family, good fortune, peace, a lovely yard of, opportunities for learning and growth, and all of these things. All we have to do is look and see all the people in the world who do not have that, right? How circumstantial it is. Then there is the realm of the fighting demons who can see into heaven, but they're not in heaven, so they're just really envious. They just really just want something else. They just know too many people who spend a lot of time in this realm. Although I think I spent some time in this realm in my life, and it usually had to do with a weird kind of competition with people in my community. Were never necessarily aware of that, but there was always a sense of like, I need to be on the lookout for numero uno because these other people are going to get ahead of me if I don't, assert myself. There's the beast realm. Oh, and how to get out of that realm is essentially self-discipline. It's like, you got it pretty good. So the precepts would be a great, like, do not indulge anger, do not speak ill of others, do not dwell on past mistakes. So, essentially a moral discipline. But in the beast realm, and I call it beast instead of animal because I think it's insulting to animals to think that all animal, I don't think all animals are in the beast realm. But I think the beast realm is like our awareness, our consciousness, our interest is just shrunk down to like we just want to eat, sleep, have sex, be comfortable. That's it. And when I think about these realms, like there's circumstances in the world can kind of push us toward one of these realms. Maybe illness or poverty or whatever could push us toward this realm. Depression can push us toward this realm. But there we are in the realm, right? We recognize like our view has just become very small. It says that the way to get out of that realm is to cultivate awareness of karma. Cultivate awareness of the importance of our choices, that we could make a choice and it can just keep us there, or we can make a choice that starts moving us out of that realm. The hell realm is one where we are not just that we feel anger, but that we have said yes to anger. Where we have gone down that road and we are nurturing it. And I think, and the irony is that when we are in this realm, our attention is focused outwards, but we are we're putting ourselves in hell. We think in some ways that we are doing what is justified, or maybe we are hurting the object of our resentment, but we're actually creating hell for ourselves, which I would love to be able to just sit down the entire United States and make both sides think carefully about this realm, right? Like the hell realm that we are putting ourselves in by just hating and vilifying the other side. I have a this is visiting family a week and a half ago. I have an uncle who we don't talk about politics, thankfully, right? I know that he has very different, like if I am gonna draw the lines and put those people over there who I think are just totally wrong and despicable, he'd be over there. And he is a sweet and wonderful and kind guy. I love him, right? And like, as I'm sitting there, I'm like, if this is the medicine for that hatred, and yet it challenges us internally. We want things to be simple. So that's the hell realm. And then the hungry ghost realm is where we are seeking to fill that void, that inner void with something, with a relationship, with an experience, with money, with even with spiritual practice, right? We're seeking to fill that void with something that is essentially external to us, when what we need to do is actually practice. We actually need to face that sense of lack within ourselves and heal ourselves. So, yes, Mark.
You didn't actually say how to get out of the hell realm.
Out of the hell realm. Out of the hell realm is just, I mean, this seems like overly simplistic, and yet ultimately, if you yourself have found yourself in this realm and you find your and you get out, you just give up your anger. You just give it up. You just give up your hatred. You just, I mean, and it sounds easier if it, easier said than done, right? And then there are practices to help us do that, which I think are all of the things that we do. Zazen and Sangha and precepts and study and all of these things are increasing our ability to work with our minds, to recognize what it is that is causing a problem, how to actually let go of it. But essentially, like the like our precept about anger, do not contrive reality for the self, to recognize that that anger and hatred, and we're not talking about the initial anger, right? We often talk about anger like it's a completely legitimate response when we think something needs to be protected, but anger lasts about like 30 seconds. Right? Like it's, uh-oh, something needs to be protected, so it might propel us into action. And that is fine. But almost any sustenance of that later becomes, I mean, we should really just have a different word for it, right? Whatever. When we call it hatred, hatred sounds a little too extreme sometimes, but anyway, when we nurse that, we are contriving reality for the self. And that reality can seem so real. That reality can make us do crazy stuff. That reality can cause people to kill each other. And yet it's all just an illusion. Yes, Denny.
I just wanted to say really briefly that, well, first, I can relate to your story with your uncle. I have a lot of extended family that I spend time with, especially lately because my mother passed away. And I've been really thinking hard about this. And one of the things I ended up telling myself was ego really loves anger. Especially as you just pointed out, when it's not a momentary thing that makes you want to spring to action to like prevent cruelty or something like that, it just eats and eats and eats. And the longer you let it do that, the more you're absolutely certain that you are the one that's right. And so I've just been, I mean, it's a broad thing and we all talk about this and I'm sure we've all experienced it. I'm just trying to work on the no self and letting go and trying to end up in the middle and looking deeply and realizing that those people, as you just said, many, if not most or all of them, are good intentioned people. They just are stuck in this view of the world that, and y yesterday I even just ask myself, well, are you the one that's wrong? Is it possible that you're wrong? And so anyway, I'm just trying to work on that, letting the ego go a little bit and just some equanimity. It's hard.
It is very hard, and I think for the very fact that only on rare occasions might we go, could I be wrong? It's like, but then we react like deep within, we're like, no, about the fundamental things. Kindness and compassion and taking care of people and not judging and ostracizing people and like and a value of truth and yet I have a sense that yeah, that's all well and good, but there's still a whole worldview that we build around that, which isn't so much wrong as is incomplete. And it's very tricky because that you can't really, right? I would love to have a real conversation with somebody on the opposite end of the political spectrum from me, but one that is like really open and respectful, right? Which is very tricky because I don't want to just be like, pontificated at or whatever. But I do get a little bit of a sense of like there is something those who are across the spectrum from us, they have values too. And we are not perceiving what those values are. We may, in the, even if we do, we may disagree with how to honor them. But I think there's a whole realm of values, tradition, family connections, a sense of, I mean, the world can be quite disorienting with all of this. I mean, who are we even, right? Like we have no context anymore. And but some people, for better or for worse, they do have context. They have family in their small town. They have context. They have context in their church and in their shared beliefs and all of that. They have context, which is incredibly integral to their sense of themselves. They're not, and it's very like to perceive the freedom that we feel being able to go, screw everything. I'm going to live exactly how I want. Tomorrow I'm a man. Today I'm a woman. Like, that is just like for them is terrifying and insulting. Right? There's no answer, but I like that, like what could I not be seeing? And that even if we can't figure it out, just a little bit of that humility of like what might I be missing softens us a little bit. John.
Again, thank you for the talk, Danielle. So question. When I ask the question, what do I want to have accomplished or whatever, it's kind of a self type thing. Would the Buddha ask that question like that, or would he pose the question in a different way where it wasn't so self-centered? Is there like a larger, more expansive context to ask the question in? And does that help at all?
It is a very good question. When and it so in recommending this hack, so there should be a little bit of a context and explanation, right? I think each of us has to navigate this for ourselves, but there's a way we could ask that question, which is kind of small self-centered, right? I could say, what do I want to have accomplished, right? Well, I'd like to have written a book, and I'd like, my podcast, I'd like to be able to be financially independent when my husband retires. And I'd like, BrightWay's in to, become large and self-sustaining. And I'd there's all kinds of stuff that I can think of that I would like to have accomplished, but that's not exactly what I'm getting at. It's like, but not what do I want to have accomplished, but how do I want to have lived? It's like the how. It's like at a deeper level. So if we kind of wash away all the ways that this might manifest, kind of letting go of any of the ways that it might manifest, regardless of circumstances, how do I want to have engaged my life? Does that make more sense? So, and then in which case, I do not feel that that's, it is rooted in a kind of self, I guess, but it's not selfish. I mean, it's self in the sense that, well, I've got this manifestation, this lifetime. This is the only vehicle that I have. But the things that arise when I ask, how do I want to have lived, are very consistent with the Bodhisattva vow.
Yeah, it just derived from a larger context, and I'm just trying to hack the larger context or something like that. Like, what do I want to have happen everywhere? And then what's my part in it? Maybe, I don't know. I was just kind of curious from a Buddhist standpoint.
Yeah. I'm thinking, like, how do I want to have lived regardless of what happens? Let's see. And there's Leah and then Katie.
Yeah, I was thinking in relation to what we were just talking about, like relating to others that have different opinions and lifestyles and whatever that are just so different from us, and not reacting with the usual feelings of pushing away, which manifests as anger or hatred or whatever, the pushing away the other. I think that you put it, I don't know, a few weeks ago, you said something about we're telling ourselves a story, and that story is very little of it is true. Like, as we're walking around perceiving our lives and everything we're getting is a story. When we tell ourselves anything or turn on the TV or talk to somebody, I mean, unless you're seeing it right in front of your face, it's all a story, really. And so I like to think of that helps me, because when I think about others who are maybe very different from me, I think about what stories that they believe and what stories they've been told. And we don't have any I don't think we have any real choice as to a lot of the stories we're told. We're just sort of in the world, and there are stories, and we just believe them or don't. And it's just helpful to me to remember the that they're stories, and that they seem real, but they're not. And so that helps me kind of relate to other people in that way. So.
Thank you. Like that. And I do want to say that, it's just so important to keep in mind the middle way here, because we can go off on either extreme, or whatever aspect of our practice, we can go on one side or the other. And in this case, one extreme would be, I got to hold on to those stories. I got to work for justice, and those people are evil, and I've got the right answer. And right, like really concretizing that. But then on the other side, it's like, well, everyone has their stories. And my story about the injustice of, thousands of people living without shelter in Portland every night. Well, it's just a story. And those who are responsible, right? So like the middle way is a living dynamic way where we don't get caught in either of those extremes. And the beauty and irony is that when we drop our story, when we not you can't just drop them, right? Like you can't, they're there. But when you recognize them as stories, right? And you recognize, okay, this is the way that I see it. This other person has their way they see it. When we recognize that, it actually frees us up. It actually helps us see things more clearly and respond more appropriately with less extra, extra hatred and bitterness and burnout and energy there. It's just stepping outside that story and engaging with things in a more real way. Katie.
So I just wanted to go back to the beginning of your talk, and I enjoyed the whole idea of summer being like heaven. And I started thinking as I was sitting there, all the different little heavens we have around us. Then a couple of days ago, I lost a very good friend. She died of a cerebral hemorrhage.
Wow.
So it was like, and so I'm kind of trying to make sense of it. And she was part of a friend group that I've been a part of for 30 years, 30, 35 years. And I was like thinking about that friend group and how when we were young, we had little kids, we'd get together, we were just enjoying each other, but there was like a lot more of that testing of each other, not sure, is this really, are you guys really my friends? And it's there was some point a couple of years ago when that just dissolved and it's like, yeah, you guys are my friends. And so I was in this little bubble, heaven bubble with that group. And then now we've just lost our first member. And it kind of pulls you back and it makes you realize that, impermanence. It's, impermanence. And, but I do know that when I just decided, yeah, you guys were my friends, every time I would go and get together with those wonderful women, I would enjoy it. It was like full body enjoyment. And I think that that's, I mean, I don't know if the Buddha ever talked about that, but for me, that feels like a way because you're in the present and you're being there with people without reserve. And so I'm just want to continue that with the friends that are still left in the group. And I don't, I'm not so sure that I have answers for, the hatred thing and everything, but I do think that one way of being a good Buddhist is to be in the moment. And when you're being in the moment with your friends, it's a whole lot better to be just loving them rather than evaluating. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
That sounds like a how I want to have lived.
Yes, how I want to live going forward.
I want to be not defensive and kind of self-conscious and whatever, but just open and engaged. And I think because this, how I want to have lived is not tied to specifics, that is a nice thing to carry with us through all the various activities. during this time of year, because it's how do I want to have experienced this moment? How do I want to have been present with my family members, or how do I want to have engaged in this thing that I'm so fortunate to be able to experience? As opposed to, like, and I can't read your minds, but I do know that on the rare occasions where I run into somebody in the grocery store or something locally, and it's usually somebody almost always, no matter how recently they've been at the Zen Center, almost always the person says something like, I'm really busy lately. I've had some, responsibilities. The job has been really busy, So, like, in a way, I think it's easy for us to think of practice and be like, oh, I haven't been going as much. I haven't been sitting as much as I should. I don't, So it's always a sense of like, I'm not doing those things over there I should be doing. And I mean, to some extent, it's true, right? To some extent, it's like, this is, Zazen's helpful, Sangha's helpful, study's helpful, exercising is helpful, right? So you might similarly go like, I probably should be getting to the gym more often. If you saw your trainer, you'd do the same thing. You'd be like, I've just been now working in my yard a lot instead of going to the gym. So, I mean, it's natural to feel a little bit of that. And I like to think that over the course, when we do loosen up the container of practice a little bit, in the fall, you'll be like, I'm ready for some structure again. Like, bring it on. Because we benefit from structure, but we let it come and go. Did you have? Okay, Mark.
It's funny you mentioned that because I work on a great big office campus with thousands of people, and there's, three or four BrightWay people there at any given time. And when I run into them in the cafeteria, I get the same thing. I'm not the truancy officer. It's an instinct. How do you want to have lived? A big part of my friend group, and maybe it's just universal to the human condition, feels like we're just sort of pretending to be adults, right? Like we're children with mortgages. We're not real adults. And I wrangle with this. As I trudge towards 50, it becomes increasingly silly to ask who I want to be when I grow up, right? But there's also something really useful there, which is you can turn around and look back and ask, who have I been? And meet yourself that way. And so maybe I just wanted to suggest that maybe a different way to hold this question is, who have I been when I was at my best? And maybe that's who I want to have been, how I want to have lived.
It can sound a little, I don't know. It can sound a little grim to say, keep your practice alive, go out and enjoy things, right? But just like, keep in mind impermanence. Keep in mind you could die at any moment, right? But if you actually make that practice, it's not it, the effects are not, they don't have to be morbid. They actually can really bring appreciation alive. It's like extending your perspective. You're like, wow. I mean, I was recently with family in Minnesota, and like, any given moment, just sitting there at my uncle's table. He's the one on hospice, so I'd gone to visit him, and his uncles and aunts and whatever, and they're like, I don't, the topic of conversation is what? It's like the little small town that we're all from. They're tearing up the front street. Are they putting in new sewer lines? I think I had lead sewer to my house, but no, they aren't lead. You're only going to be digging up into the street. They're not going to replace the lines to the houses. Like, it's a big long conversation. And I just, so kind of objectively, what's so great about this, right? Like there's nothing. And yet when I sat back, I'm just like, this is it. This is what I flew across country to just be here. And so that kind of when I'm not like that and I'm enjoying something, I feel vaguely, I don't maybe different, but I feel a little bit guilty the whole time. Just a little bit, just like, I don't know, there's so many people who can't enjoy this kind of thing. This is just pleasurable. It's not useful. It's not productive. There's so many things that need to be done. But when I put it in that larger context, how do I want to have lived? It's like there's a place for that. There's a place for. Of course, I want, when I look back, do I want to have had moments which are just, I'm not asking what the productive value is, just enjoying it, right? Just being present. Let's see. Eric. Oh, sorry, Ruthann, go ahead. And then Eric.
I have been reading Thich Nhat Hanh's How to See, came out in 2019, and he talks about the capital R, like the right way, he said is the trap of words. The right way is actually wrong because the right way isn't the only viewpoint. And if I think about like being an architect, looking at a full building, you can't see every side of the building at once. I mean, from a human's point of view, even if you do aerials, you're not seeing every point, every view in that building. So, Thich Nhat Hanh was just saying the right way isn't every single view. So we can't always hold every view at once, but just to recognize it's not the only viewpoint. And hospice nurses say that there are people who, as they exit this life, might have a chance to review. So their question is, whose life do you want to review? Did you live your life, not someone else's dream for you or expectations? So just cutting ourselves some slack, I mean, as human beings, and because there are so many other agendas that society and other people could have for us. So just, and even like what you mentioned, just being in a conversation or listening to people talk about their garden or their own world just is, in a way, humbling. I'll finish with First Voices Radio. Indigenous people say, oh yeah, it's not just New Age, be here now. But their take is, that's still new for mainstream white society, whereas they've been many times living that far longer than we realize. Thank you for this discussion.
Thank you, Ruthann. Eric.
It's interesting that you brought this up. This is actually, they all three kind of have gone together in my experience. I not only have a lot of family, an uncle, a father, who are very much in another place politically and value-wise, but then also a lot of the friends or people I was working with were also, in different value places. Even people who I consider, you know, close friends or liberal, were very much in a non-consideration, non-kind focus. And one of your podcasts, you talked about how that if we're practicing, that we might as well practice to be a Buddha. That if we're going to be practicing anyway, we might as well try and shoot for the best. And that really resonated with me. I come from a very strong Christian tradition, and Christ nature and Buddha nature are cohesive, I guess. And so for me, what I did in order to deal with those people who are in that hell or hellish realm, I chose to take your advice and the wisdom seriously and literally, and just kind of be, because I tried arguing, I tried convincing, I tried setting example, I tried all that and nothing worked. So I kind of just gave up and decided just I would be who I wanted to be and who I needed or wanted other people to be to me. And what I found as I did that, things kind of just fall away. And what I found was that I was able to find things that are more in common, not only with people who don't believe like I do, but even with people who do believe like I do or believe differently or are just, you know, randomly coming into my life or in my life for a long time, is by just being that and doing that and looking at everyday life, every part of life as a practice. And, you know, every time, you know, I get frustrated or challenged, it's like, hey, this is here to teach me something. And then when I'm not having that, it's like, hey, well, let me practice something. So I kind of have brought the three of them together to kind of deal with that issue of dealing with people with hellish. So I really relate and I appreciate this.
Thank you. Yeah, you reminded me of, I don't know, I feel like everybody's different, but there have been times in my life, it's been a long time now, but where I have felt lonely and like, you know, that is that person really my friend? You know, they're not calling me and call me back. They don't seem to really want to be with me, whatever, family members, you know, it's not the closeness that I hope for. So like a sense of lack in terms of, you know, how people are responding or paying attention or all of those things. And I could just get very, very miserable, right? And I can dream up stories about how that's because I'm so shitty and unlikable and whatever. And I found the most effective way to get out of that hell realm was to think like, maybe Joan's lonely. Maybe I should give her a call. Like to be
yes
a generous, thoughtful person.
Yes.
Like I'm just like nobody come. You know, and it's like, well, there's lots of lonely people out there. Like just go be nice. Go be nice and generous. And then it's like that whole, like, I would like to say, and you know, to some extent it's true that then it changed what other people did, but that's not really what it's about, right? I'm just like, pretty much instantly, I am in a world where there is generosity and kindness. And, you know, and other people, that's their life. They can be thoughtful or generous or kind or not, or maybe they're paying attention to somebody else. But, you know, that kind of, yeah, if you're lonely, give kindness.
Yes.
Wow, that brings us to the end. So didn't even have to go into the envelope. abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas
throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you all for coming. Bye-bye.